For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. Here to talk about America's and NATO's war against Serbia 10 years ago is Nebojsa Malik. He writes Moments of Transition, formerly Balkan Express, at antiwar.com. You can find it at antiwar.com/Malik. And he also writes the blog greyfalcon.blogspot.com. Welcome to the show, Nebojsa. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for holding on through that terrible Bill Clinton speech. And forgive me, please, for having gone so long since I've invited you on the show. It's been years and years, and I guess my problem is I don't know too much about the Balkans in general, and I have no real way of keeping track of who's who or any kind of thing, and there hasn't been too much big news in these intervening years to cover, and I've sort of just, you know, let it slip under my radar. Not that the issue has been resolved at all. So my apologies to you and my sincere welcome to the show. It's really good to talk to you again and to have you here. Let's start with the Rambouillet Accord. That's what Bill Clinton was just talking about there, the peace agreement. The Kosovars have already agreed to it. The Serbs won't agree to it. And yet I seem to remember there was something funny about calling that thing a peace agreement at the time. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, you remember correct. I was going to say, commenting on the whole speech by Clinton, that, surprise, surprise, just about everything in that speech was a lie, including the end and the. And among other things, so was the notion that, together with the Western allies and Russia, there was a peace proposal in Rambouillet. The thing that was proposed in Rambouillet was not talked over with Russians, it was not talked over with anybody, really. It was an ultimatum. It was an ultimatum that distilled to two sentences, basically said, okay, you will surrender Kosovo to NATO occupation, allow NATO to roam freely through Serbia, and give Albanians independence within 3 years, or else. That was it.
Yes. So it was an offer they couldn't possibly accept, basically.
It was designed not to be accepted. As a matter of fact, the 1,300-page document issued by the Hague Tribunal last month, as part of their justification for the ridiculous verdict against the Serbian political and military leadership over the Kosovo War, included a quote from Clinton himself, who said that he wouldn't have signed the agreement had he had that choice. So to say that Serbs rejected peace is just downright facetious, but then again, what else could we expect from Clinton?
Right, yeah, well, and that's the whole thing. He was a master at words. I remember being in awe sometimes of the detailed nuances and kind of side escape hatches built into the excuses he would give. It's really something to behold, watching him edit his phony answer as he gives it in such a masterful way. He always was great at that.
Yeah, no wonder a lot of people thought him the Antichrist at the time.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I ever went that far, but I sure thought he was a felon and should be convicted as one, as far as that goes.
I didn't think him the Antichrist myself either, but a lot of people did.
Yeah, well, everybody thinks everybody's the Antichrist nowadays. But anyway, so the other thing is, too, here, that, well, I want to try to wrap my head around. The way I remember this was the U.S. had made a giant precedent, basically, when the Soviet Union fell, as George Carlin said, couldn't wait to go and play with our toys in the sand. We went over there to intervene in a war between two neighboring states, neither of which was an ally of ours, where Iraq, or actually I guess one of them was the aggressor, where Iraq invaded Kuwait, and we went and intervened in that border dispute war that had nothing to do with our country at all. And then the Serbian war, and I guess to a lesser extent, at least as far as my understanding, the previous interventions in the Balkans, but particularly the war against Serbia for Kosovo, was the precedent set there was, if America doesn't like what you're doing inside your own country, And it wasn't even really a civil war, is my understanding. They weren't even really trying to break free completely. They just wanted autonomy, the Albanian Kosovars did. So it wasn't even really a civil war going on. And it was just basically, you know, if we don't like your policy inside your country, America reserves the right to, you know, I guess get England and France and whoever to gang up on you, use NATO if necessary, to bomb the hell out of your country until you do what we say.
That's more or less technically correct. I mean, I wrote a couple of essays yesterday in a variety of languages, and one of my theses was that the Gulf War wasn't exactly the first battle of the future, but the last battle of the past.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a bookend to the Cold War. Massive confrontation of armies in the open field, UN security authorization, and all that. But it was the first step on the road that the U.S. followed in the 1990s. Which was to craft, sort of like, putting Legos together, build a precedent, a tower of precedence, so to speak, so that at the end of this, the end result would be the ability of Washington to bomb, invade, occupy, or blockade anybody, anywhere, for any reason. When the Bosnian and the Croatian wars started in 1991 and 92, respectively, NATO was minimally involved. It was charged with enforcing the blockade of Yugoslavia. And then it was charged with enforcing the no-fly zone, and then to support the safe areas, and then it was the dual key for airstrikes, and then in the end, in Bosnia 95, it was airstrikes without any UN authorization. And then in 1999, it was basically one of those, okay, well, we know it's illegal, we know there's no legal cover for this at all, we're not even going to bother to invent one. We're just going to say this is a horrible genocide and we have to stop it, and who cares what the Constitution or charters or anything else says. Except, of course, it wasn't a genocide. There were no widespread atrocities that Clinton was speaking of. The events that he was talking about, the people lined up and shot, at that particular point in time, that was absolutely not the truth. He was lying through his teeth, as usual. And
well, on that point, let me stop you there for a second.
Sure.
Forgive me, but the point about the mass graves is all important here. Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and himself included in that clip, referred basically to either outright genocide or at least massive ethnic cleansing going on. Thousands of people killed. In some cases, they claimed as many as 100,000 people who are missing and presumed murdered. And yet, the fact really is, as you just alluded to, they never found the mass graves that supposedly existed. They had released satellite photos and all these things. And yet, as John Pilger reported, the FBI special forensic teams left after 2 weeks, and the UN doctor groups or whatever that were sent in to examine the mass graves were quoted angrily saying, "We've been used and conned, and this whole thing never even happened." It was like Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program.
Right, that's correct. I mean, the final body count that they found in individual graves, individual, not mass graves, was just north of 2,000 people. And I think the research that's been done since, but not publicized at all, added up all the civilian and military casualties, including the KLA fighters, who cannot justly be counted as innocent civilians in any way, shape, or form. And they amounted to less than 8,000 people total, and that's Serbs and Albanians, victims of bombing as well as fighting. So no mass graves at all. In fact, the only two mass graves that I recall seeing stories about were mass graves of Serbs butchered by the KLA. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is, to say the least, disingenuous. And the number of 10,000 that's routinely paraded as the number of Albanian civilians killed in the conflict is absolutely wrong.
Yeah, it's really no different than the Gulf of Tonkin or the weapons of mass destruction or any of these excuses.
Well, they needed an excuse. I mean, when the war started, Clinton was talking about people getting shot in the streets and whatnot. But the official line from NATO was, "Well, we are attacking to impose the Rambouillet Agreement," which wasn't an agreement. And then within a couple of weeks, when the Serbs didn't surrender as planned, they changed the story and started talking about genocide and atrocities and all this other stuff. So even the official excuse, you know, when people try to make up an excuse for something and make up a beautiful lie and it collapses right away because it doesn't fit with the rest of their story. I mean, this was a schoolbook example of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just like they, changed the operation in Iraq from finding weapons to creating democracy for the people there and all that kind of thing. I also thought it was interesting the way they took a page right out of Ronald Reagan in that Clinton clip where he talked about the distance between Italy and Kosovo. And it sounded just like when Ronald Reagan says, yeah, well, you know, Nicaragua's closer to Harlingen, Texas than Washington, D.C. is, as though, you know, what was going on in Nicaragua was somehow a threat to the people of Texas. And Bill Clinton just basically copied and pasted that exact same kind of fear-mongering thing, as though Italy's a state in the Union anyway. You know?
Right, and to be perfectly honest, there's far bigger threat from Washington, D.C. to Texas than from Nicaragua.
No doubt about that. Yeah, well, and in fact, in the person of Bill Clinton himself, who at least on one occasion used the Army's Combat Applications Group to slaughter a bunch of men, women, and children 100 miles from where I used to live.
Right, exactly. And the commander of the military commander in Fort Hood at that time, I believe, was none other than Wesley Clark.
Uh-huh. Now, here's my favorite tidbit about Wesley Clark, other than bombing ambulances and TV stations, is that he almost started World War III. And there's an article in the BBC about the unfortunately named General Michael Jackson of the United Kingdom, who basically refused to follow Wesley Clark's orders that he thought very well could have led to a war with the Russians over the Pristina airport.
Exactly, yes. When the bombing ended in June because of there was a compromise agreement, a compromise treaty giving Serbia sovereignty on paper. It was a step back from the Rambouillet demands, and people today mock the insistence of the Serbs that they had won, but in essence, they've managed to hold off NATO for over 3 months and in the end settle for some sort of a compromise agreement as opposed to outright capitulation. Well, as the first part of that, the Russians deployed a paratrooper unit at the Pristina airport, which came as a total surprise to NATO, and including their clients in Moscow. And Clark ordered the British troops under Jackson's command to dislodge the Russians by force, and Jackson refused. And that's how that situation got diffused, and there was no conflict between NATO and the Russians at that particular point.
Mm-hmm. I remember that, too, live on CNN at the time, and they said, oh, that's just in. The Russians have gone and moved into the Pristina airport before we could get there. Oh, no. And they were really not prepared for what they were getting into there. They certainly hadn't prepared the American people with the understanding that the Russians view the Serbs as their little cousins that they have to protect.
Well, no, and that's actually been stressed in propaganda over the last 8 years that Serbs are nothing but surrogate Russians anyway, which is not necessarily the case. I mean, these are two distinct people with two distinct histories. They do have a lot in common, but Serbia is by no way, shape, or form a client state of Russia. In fact, the relationship between Serbia and Russia is they're much more independent partners than, for example, the UK and the US. I mean, the Britain's relationship to the United States can be described as vassal, and Serbia is much more different in that respect than Russia.
Well, even in the days of the Cold War, Yugoslavia stayed separate from the Soviet Union.
Very correct.
Yeah. Which is, and I guess, see, this is the problem here, too, is when that ended, everybody, and I don't know in what order and who started what and which all are the guilty parties, but basically when the Soviet Union fell apart, everybody started dividing up upon ethnic lines, and the country didn't just divide, it tore itself apart.
Yes, and actually Yugoslavia preceded the Soviet Union in that. In 1991, the only three republics that had declared independence from the Soviet Union were the Baltic republics, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, because they had been independent states in the 1940s and they were incorporated into the Soviet Union against their will. But the Soviet Union itself did not fall apart until late 1991, and by that time the war in Yugoslavia was already raging, and the precedent in Yugoslavia, the decision by the EU completely out of the blue that it was the republics, which were these administratively created entities by the communists, not states, but somebody drew lines on a map and said, okay, this is Slovenia, this is Croatia, this is Montenegro, this is Macedonia, this is Serbia, this is Bosnia. And the EU said, well, these are states, and they have the right to secede. And they simply copied that approach to the Soviet Union, and they found a very favorable actor in that respect in Boris Yeltsin, who said, oh, yeah, fine, you know, let all these other republics secede, and I've got Russia. Who cares?
Well, and isn't part of this, too, that when the Americans came in, was it the very same lines that the communists had drawn, that the Americans said, okay, these are the borders now?
And absolutely.
They were That's sort the biggest- of, my understanding, I guess, and I think I remember this from talking with you years ago, is that there were already basically soft lines on the ground. In practice, the river divides these people from those and that kind of thing. But then Richard Holbrook, I guess it was, came in and said, no, 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 the river is a dark black magic marker line on my map. It's an international border now for real. And then that made it where all these people who were already kind of going through all this ethnic cleansing anyway, it all got turned to fast forward as all these people were left on the, quote, wrong side of the lines, right?
This happened a little before Holbrook, but in essence, you're right. What was the case is that the communists drew lines on a map according to a program from the 1920s when they had decided that Yugoslavia was a very bad thing and that it had to be broken apart, and all these people that were had just recently joined Yugoslavia following World War I were horribly mistaken and were actually enslaved. Well, in 1941, when the Germans attacked, they partitioned Yugoslavia in a manner very similar to the borders you see today. And the communists led a resistance movement that wasn't really a resistance movement so much as let's wait till the Russians get here, well, the Soviets, really. And the royalists, who were trying to preserve Yugoslavia, adopted the approach of, well, let's wait until the British get here. And, of course, the British never came, and the Russians did. So the communists got installed into power in 1945, and they were thinking, okay, well, time to implement our program, but, you know, there's a little problem with that. We now control this country. Why would we want to give it up? So instead of breaking up Yugoslavia like they planned, they broke it up internally and kept overall control. But in order to do that, they had to partition Serbia, and so they created these provinces in the north and in the south, created Kosovo so it would be an ethnic Albanian majority province. It was also the heartland of Serbian culture with the wealth of monasteries and churches and chapels and monuments and castles and all this. I mean, this is the historical heartland of Serbia. And they basically gave it to the Albanians to administer. And at this point, Albanians were the most radical communists in Europe. They had broken with Stalin. They had broken with the Soviets as well as with everybody else. They were declared themselves the only true communists and allied themselves with Mao's China. So Yugoslavia was getting a lot of refugees from Enver Hoxha's Albania. And these people, they contributed to the ethnic imbalance in the province. And so I'm not going to go so far as to say that the communists deliberately ethnically cleansed the Serbs, but they certainly allowed it to happen because it didn't really bother their designs. The weaker the Serbs were, the easier it was to run the country, because Serbs, as a nation, were about half of Yugoslavia's population, but they were broken up into four or five entities. And that's the way they administered the country. Well, the Serbs didn't really object too much until the late 80s, when the whole division became too much and Serbia couldn't function as a country at all, because the provinces had veto power over anything the Serbian parliament decided. And can you imagine, for example, Vermont being able to veto every single law in the Senate?
Oh, that would be awesome.
Well, yes. I mean, from a libertarian perspective, that would be fantastic. But the provinces could legislate on their own, but could veto every decision in the Serbian parliament. And
well, I can certainly see how this could have been part of the leading up to the crisis there.
Right, but can you imagine that if only Vermont could veto everything in the Senate and every other state did not have that right?
Yeah.
That could obviously be a problem for interstate relations. And that's when Milosevic stepped in. This sense of injustice and oppression and of unworkable setup is what propelled him to power in the late 80s. And he rose within the communist apparatus to become the chairman of the Communist Party and then president of Serbia. But in the other statelets, in the other republics throughout Yugoslavia, you had these communists as well, or nationalists who the communists had previously jailed, rising to power and preaching ideas of independence, secession. Okay, you know, we've gotten everything out of Yugoslavia that we could have possibly wanted. Let's just pack up and go. That situation was inflamed by 1990, and then the Soviet Union collapsed, communism collapsed, and all of a sudden there was no there was no sense of balance between East and West that kept Yugoslavia together for the longest time. And in that sort of situation, things started up. It's a complete lie that Milosevic started a war in Slovenia. He had nothing to do with that. And the Slovenians, some of whom are alive and in power to the present day, emphatically brag about starting the war and killing the Federal Army troops and customs agents. And the Croatians have publicly, the late Croatian president publicly admitted that there wouldn't have been a war had I not wanted one. The late Bosnian Muslim leader said that he was prepared to sacrifice peace for independence. I mean, all these people who are saying the Serbs started the war have also at a different time admitted that they had in fact started the war. So again, we're going back to Clinton's speech and the fact that it's a complete reversal of reality.
What's the significance of the news that this one guy whose name I can't remember, who was, I guess, an aide or worked under Milosevic, turns out that he was a CIA agent all along, came out a couple weeks ago?
Right, well, he was actually the Serbian equivalent of the head of the CIA. He was the head of the Serbian security service.
And this is a guy who's being tried for war crimes in The Hague right now. That's how this came out, right?
And not just any war crime. The charges against him is that he organized special execution squads to go into Bosnia and Croatia and kill people. So he's being framed as a Serbian equivalent of Heinrich Himmler. Because the whole narrative that's being advanced in the Hague Tribunal and in the media over the past 20 years is that the Serbs are the new Nazis. Milosevic was Hitler, his generals were Keitel and Jodl, and this fellow Stanisic was Himmler, who planned and executed the genocide. Well, there's no evidence for genocide, and they don't care about that. They never attack the issue head-on because they have no proof. But what they do is they say, okay, well, he organized these groups, and one of these groups that may have been connected with these other groups, but it wasn't, had shot some people on a mountainside somewhere, and we have videotape of this. So therefore, he's guilty of genocide. And so Stanisic, knowing that he's being framed, try to save his skin by appealing to the CIA and saying, look, I helped you guys out. You got to throw me a bone here. And they did, after a fashion. And they leaked that piece to the Los Angeles Times a couple of weeks ago. And it sort of dovetailed into the verdict the previous week to the generals of the Serbian army and the chief of staff and the minister of defense and so on that were all convicted of some grand conspiracy to expel the Albanians from Kosovo, despite the fact that no evidence whatsoever was presented for this.
So, but what happened last week or a couple weeks ago, what you're saying is that it was the CIA that leaked it as a favor to this guy, rather than he leaked it to say, hey, CIA stabbing me in the back, I was their guy.
Well, I don't know who leaked it, and it's a bit of a mystery. The letter that the CIA sent to the tribunal was sent in 2004, so it's been 5 years. He's not yet on trial because he's very ill. He's got liver issues, I believe, and he's under medical care. But the piece appeared in the L.A. Times and it was very well researched, and obviously the fellow who researched it had spent some time on it. So the timing of the publication of the article was very interesting.
Well, and, you know, Raimondo was talking today at antiwar.com about the news in the New York Times that Richard Holbrooke had made a deal with Radovan Karadzic that he could be free and would be left alone as long as he stayed out of politics. And then Holbrooke got mad because the guy got involved in something. I'm not sure what, because then when they found him, he'd been hiding for 10 years. So what's going on there?
Well, I think there should be a phrase in the English language, in colloquial English language, something along the lines of Holbrooke's agreement.
Yeah.
to denote a bargain that the other party never really was even slightly interested in honoring.
That's a Holbrooke agreement. I like that. I'm going to try to use that.
Agreement. So, first of all, yes, there was a deal between Holbrooke and Karadzic. There's documentary evidence for this, and Holbrooke can't keep on denying it. But, so what if there was? I mean, the tribunal's already said, well, we don't take orders from Holbrooke. Yes, they take orders from the guy that Holbrooke took orders from, but that's beside the point. They can always claim plausible deniability and say, well, how is that any of our business? Which is exactly what they're doing. Yes, Karadzic had a deal to withdraw from politics. He stepped down and stepped away and basically disappeared after 1996. And Holbrooke is now salvaging his case because for the previous year, 8 months since Karadzic's capture, last July in Belgrade, he was saying there was no deal. This is complete nonsense. These are filthy lies intended to smear my reputation. Well, given that the man was on the board of AIG for the past couple of years, I don't think his reputation can be sullied any further.
Yeah, well, yeah, Holbrooke and his reputation, I wasn't sure that there was one. And I think that's part of the deal. To be in the imperial court, you have to have no shame, and you have to have no ability to recognize that people already hate your guts because of the terrible things you've done, yeah?
None whatsoever, and Holbrooke actually goes the extra mile because he's proud of all the things he does. That's one of his defining qualities in respect to the other diplomats, you know, when they're called on something, and they start apologizing, and, well, we didn't really mean it that way, and it was this but not that.
Yeah.
Holbrooke is not completely unapologetic. He said, yeah, sure, I hate the Serbs. I'm proud of it.
Well, what was this about? Because I know Bill Clinton doesn't care about a make-believe 100,000 dead people, and I do know that there is a massive base called Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, and is that, what, straddling a pipeline? Is that what this whole thing is about?
The whole project for a pipeline that's pretty much DOA, that pipeline's fiction. There's been a lot of theories surrounding that, yes. But a couple of years back, Chris DeLiso wrote a review on anti-war of a book called Collision Force by a fellow named John Norris, who's advisor for the International Crisis Group, which has been a bunch of retired U.S. diplomats trying to steer foreign policy using plausible deniability as a non-governmental organization. And the introduction to that book was written by none other than Clinton's point man on foreign policy, Strobe Talbot, the Russia expert in the Clinton administration. And according to Talbot and Norris, this was all part of the great game aimed against Russia. It was never about Kosovo. It was never about the Serbs. It was about control of Europe and domination of Russia.
So basically just putting the base there's sake.
Right, but it was part of the whole project of, okay, we need to make friends in the Islamic world because the Islamic world stretches into Central Asia, and we need Central Asia to control Asia as a whole, which means, you know, we can use them against the Russians, the Chinese, and the Indians, and that's how we're going to perpetuate our global hegemony into the 21st century.
Hmm.
And, you know, from Zbigniew Brzezinski's grand chessboard to some of Kissinger's ideas, there's a lot of baggage here, but it boils down to, okay, we want to control Europe, so we can control Asia, and if we control Asia, we can control the world. It's the kind of thinking that, you know, reminds you of a risk player as opposed to a statesman, but that's what they did. So it was never really about the Serbs or the Albanians. They were just a bit players in the whole thing, which makes it all the more disgusting.
Right. And see, that's the thing, too. Any of these foreign policy discussions, you know, I think about how much time was spent explaining how invading Iraq and killing a bunch of people is not a good way to spread democracy or whatever, but that's just time spent caught up disputing the smokescreen rather than getting to the real point, which is the clean break for the Likudniks and expanding the footprint into Eurasia, as you're talking about.
Right. The pieces are really coming together when you take a look at all the statements from people like Joseph Biden or who was that late representative from California, Lantosh, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And people like that, you know, there's just a whole wealth of resources online that people attract. All these U.S. policymakers saying, well, you know, we're friends with the Muslims. Look what we did in Bosnia and Kosovo. Look how we saved the Kuwaitis. It seems to me almost as if there is a push on part of one faction within the U.S. foreign policy establishment to create an alliance with the Muslim world and use them as a weapon against potential rivals, which is, to any casual observer with a grain of common sense, the most idiotic notion ever. Not saying that Muslims are supposed to be some sort of, you know, terminal horrible enemy of the United States and their destruction is necessary. No, I'm not saying that. But to play with this kind of fire.
Yeah, well, and it is. That's exactly what it is. It's the Cold War policy continued against Russia and China. And, you know, Robert Dreyfus wrote that book, Devil's Game, how the United States helped to unleash fundamentalist Islam. And it's about how Britain first and then both, and then America basically taking up the slack, supported the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course Israel created Hamas as a religious alternative to the PLO, and on, you see right-wing factions, Khomeini and his group were supported, because they helped to overthrow Mossadegh in 53, and then came back 26 years later to do the overthrow of their own, and all this, all, you know, never mind Al-Qaeda and the Afghan war, certainly it's playing with fire, and I guess nobody figures that any of the consequences matter, you know, as long as they don't come due before their particular job, in whichever bureaucracy is up and they move to a different position or something.
Exactly. Nobody cares about blowback, and blowback is what this is all about. I mean, I'm gonna break Godwin's law here, and I'm gonna invoke Hitler. Because inevitably one must. But the last person who actually had this whole wacky notion of befriending the Muslim people and using them as a weapon against the rest of the world was Hitler.
Yeah, and well, it was really the Serbs fought him too at the same time that was going
well,
on.
The Serbs fought him because they really had no choice. I mean, when somebody comes to your house with a gun and demands that you give up at gunpoint, you either submit or you fight. And the Serbs have a tradition of fighting back.
Yeah. Well, I guess it doesn't pay to be allies with America. You see what you get.
That's the only thing more dangerous than being an American enemy, being an American ally.
Well, so let's talk about the real world consequences of what's happened since this war. The Kosovo Liberation Army, are they the de facto government of Kosovo now?
Not just the de facto, but officially. The prime minister, I believe, is the leader of the Kosovo Liberation Army. I don't know whether the president is from his ranks or from the ranks of Rugova's former party. It really doesn't matter. They're all on the same page, honestly, and they don't even bother to hide it.
And how relatively criminal is this gang compared to the average government in Europe?
By about a 5 or 7 orders of magnitude. There's reports documenting the graft and the corruption and the trafficking of people and narcotics and weapons and just about anything you can imagine. That there is no law and order in that place. There are no property rights. There's no concept of anything except who has the bigger gun and who has more of it. The number of Albanians killed by other Albanians over the past 10 years is just staggering. And these are not disputes over who was loyal to Serbia or who's more pro-independence. This was one of those, okay, two clans fight over smuggling rights for heroin, and whichever clan wins gets to shoot the other one. I was reading last month, following the anniversary of the whole Declaration of Independence thing, the German sent a reporter who actually talked to the Albanians on the ground. Everybody else was all too happy to repeat all these platitudes about freedom and independence and blah, blah, blah. And the Germans sent somebody on the ground, and he actually sat down with all these young Albanians who had no jobs, no electricity, hardly ever drinking water. They spent all of the money they managed to scrounge up working odd jobs to pay for food, for lodgings. And they're actually worse off today than they were a year ago. And a year ago, they were worse off than they were in 1999. The whole war thing notwithstanding, obviously. So the Albanians who were supposed to have been saved are actually living a pretty miserable existence right now. And that's not to count the Serbs, the Gypsies, the Turks, the Slavic Muslims, all the other so-called minorities in Kosovo, people who had all the human rights and civil rights before the wars and are now basically living on the margin of society in barbed wire enclosed camps under protection of armed NATO troops, and just waiting for another Albanian mob to come down and burn them out.
How many of these different ethnic groups have been forced out? I guess at least the Serbs have Serbia to go to. What about all those other Gypsies and would you say Slavic Muslims and which other groups? Where do they go?
Well, a lot of them went to Serbia. Some of them went to Bosnia, obviously, because there were Slavic Muslims, and they went to Bosnia because they figured they'd be received better there. A lot of them went to Serbia. There are some heartbreaking refugee camps in the south of Serbia because Serbia itself is dirt poor from the bombing and the horrible mismanagement of the American client government for the past 8 years. And a lot of these people simply have been forgotten. There's almost 1 million refugees from the Yugoslav wars in Serbia alone. And they've been completely ignored.
What about just from Kosovo since the war in 99? How many refugees?
Well, the Serbian government operates with a figure that's north of 200,000. I think the numbers were even up to 250. The Albanians simply flat out deny that any of them have left, and they say, well, those who left must have been war criminals, or those who left must have left on their own volition. They flat out deny that they've expelled anybody. We know that at least 4,000 people were driven from their homes in 2004.
Well,
in
that's
March.
Your most recent article. I was going to mention at antiwar.com/Malik, M-A-L-I-C. It's The Blood-Dimmed Tide, the Kosovo Pogrom of 2004. Tell us about that.
Well, the most revolting thing about it is that it was a pogrom. It was a rerun of the 1938 pogrom of the Jews in Hitler's Germany. It was compared to that by a UN official on the ground. The American officers, the NATO officers, people who had bombed the Serbs just 5 years before, were saying, okay, this is ethnic cleansing. This is a humanitarian disaster. These people are this is an organized, systematic, deliberate destruction of an entire people. And what did any of the Albanians involved in it get arrested? Prosecuted? Tried? No, none of them. In fact, the European so-called law and order mission that just came into Kosovo a few months ago to implement the independence plan, they released the one convicted terrorist who had blown up a bus full of Serbs in 2001. The UN finally caught him after years and years and years. They tried him. They convicted him. They sentenced him to, I don't know, either 15 or 40 years. It doesn't really matter. And the Europeans said, oh, too bad. Release him. He did nothing. There's not a single shred of justice for what happened in 2004. In fact, what makes it worse is that the Albanians got independence as a result of this. Because when the pogrom began in March, so did the propaganda. And the people who were justifying these weren't riots. I mean, these were not people just randomly destroying stuff. This was 40,000 people deliberately going after Serbian villages, Serbian churches, chapels, old people in their homes, and just deliberately killing them, burning their homes, beating them up, destroying everything in their path. It was very targeted, very systematic. And immediately, the press here, the same people who engineered Rambouillet and the same people who have been advocating independence for years, have started saying, okay, well, see, these people are desperate because they're frustrated and because they're poor and because there's no independence. If you give them independence, things will be better. And that's what started the ball rolling on the whole independence process that started in 2005.
And now it's been, what, 1 year or 2 years since they declared independence?
It's been a year. Yeah, that was February 2008 when they declared independence. And they've been recognized by 56 countries, I think, by now. And most of those are either American allies or client states like Nauru, Palau, Federated States of Micronesia, and so on.
And did everything get better? I mean, I got to tell you, and you know, I know that you're a libertarian as well, and my perspective is that no state has the right to claim any territory at all. So if the people of Kosovo want to declare their independence from Belgrade, all this other, you know, criminality and what have you notwithstanding, but just, you know, all things being equal, people in states want to break apart from each other, that's fine with me. But what's at issue here is the consequences for the human beings.
Well, not just that, and you're right, and I in principle, I agree with secession in general. And this particular case is complicated by the fact that Kosovo, the property in Kosovo, the land, is over 70% of it is owned by the Serbs outright. And the Serb pockets that are in the province are emphatically denied the right to secede themselves and join Serbia, the rest of Serbia, I should say, because the U.S. is now insisting that Kosovo's borders cannot be violated, but Serbia's could. So it's an issue of no standards at all here. We're not talking double standards. We're talking, well, what the right thing to do is whatever we say because we've got the guns.
Right.
The Albanians, as I mentioned earlier, the Albanians are really, really badly off. If the system in Kosovo, if there was a system, there isn't. But if it was some sort of tribal system that the Albanians have somehow made work over the centuries, that wouldn't be a problem, really. Not for me or for them. I would have no grounds to object to it at all. But it isn't. They're not even following tribal laws of Albania. It's simply a complete not an anarchy even. It's a dictatorship of the KLA. It's a mafia state. Distilled. I mean, every state is organized crime by definition, but this is the apotheosis of organized crime, in which the mafia is the government, and you are not allowed to say anything against the government, or you will quite literally disappear.
Well, when we're talking about, I'm trying to picture as detailed the geography as I can here, and unfortunately it isn't all that detailed, but I guess my understanding is that all the heroin grown in Afghanistan and that part of Central Asia goes through this pipeline, through the so-called Turkic countries, through Turkey itself, and then in through Albania and Kosovo into Europe. And now the point here isn't drug abuse. The point here is how many tens or hundreds of billions of dollars in criminal profits and bribe money for NATO officials and who knows what else and who knows who all's in on it.
The drug trade is part of the issue. There's really this whole smuggling route from Central Asia that runs through, yes, Turkey and then Bulgaria, especially southern Bulgaria, and then it crosses into Macedonia, which is also destabilized by the Albanian insurrection from 2001. So, its law enforcement is in shambles. And then it crosses into Kosovo, and then it crosses into Albania, and from Albania it goes to Italy, and then from Italy on to Western Europe. And this is not just a conduit for drugs. This is a conduit for weapons. This is a conduit for money laundering. And, you know, drugs, weapons, money laundering, none of these are necessarily crimes against the libertarian beliefs. But the worst part about this is it's a conduit for slavery. Slaves, yes. Sex slavery, or trafficking, as the politicians like to call it, to give it sort of an air of respectability and change it from what it really is, but it's slavery.
You know, it's an interesting thing about that, because it's very rarely covered, but I think everybody knows that there is such a thing as, you know, international markets and this kind of thing, and yet it seems like the lack of high-profile busts might indicate that it's all the politicians who are the ones running these things in the first place, or what?
Well, the politicians are, I would say, probably primary customers, given the, you know, politicians' predilection for engaging prostitutes of all kinds. Obviously, this is a sweeping judgment, and I don't have any particular examples to prove it, apart from all these senators and congressmen here caught with prostitutes of various kinds. But, you know, it's publicly known. There's figures available from police sources that, for example, the Albanians control 90% of the illegal prostitution in the United Kingdom. And yet we get movies like Eastern Promises, which show that the Russians are, in fact, doing this, because nobody dares to touch the Albanians. Actually, the closest thing to the truth that I've seen in the last probably decade was the recent Luc Besson film with Liam Neeson, Taken. If you've heard of it.
Oh yeah, I saw the commercial for it.
Right. I mean, it's a story of the people who kidnap his daughter are Albanian slave traders. And there are Europeans involved, and there's Arabs involved, and there's all sorts of unsavory characters involved. It's not just the Albanians, but the Albanians are the muscle. They're the ones who do the abductions and do the initial sales. And this is the first time that anybody's actually mentioned it in the Western mainstream. And so far, I mean, until now, it's been a complete taboo.
But we do have a giant, awesome base there, right?
Indeed. Biggest base in Europe. And honestly,
I'm sorry for being so facetious, but the point there is that's the only other thing on the other side of the scale, right?
Pretty much. There's also Bill Clinton Boulevard and monuments to Madeleine Albright.
Oh, good. Bill Clinton Boulevard, huh?
Yeah. When George Bush went to Albania, 2007, and he lost his watch. Lost, right? people here were commenting, well, if you have to go to Albania to be loved, then what are we talking about here? But the truth is, Albanians, even though their existence is miserable, both in Albania proper and in Kosovo, are very enthusiastic in their support of the U.S. And it certainly appeals to Americans when they read about how, you know, you've got people around the world burning American flags and chanting death to America, and then you come to Albania or Kosovo, and everybody's like, oh, America, we love America, America, we are America friend. But, you know, you turn to history books and you dig up the photographs from the 1940s, with all these Albanians being just as enthusiastic towards Hitler and the Nazis, then you realize that it's nothing personal.
Yeah. Right. It's not a love for America. It's a love for what America's government did to separate them from Serbia. Simple as that.
Because they couldn't have ever done it on their own. I mean, it was one of those... The Albanian movement has been around since 1878, and it's been obsessed with creating the so-called ethnic Albania, which would encompass parts of Serbia and Montenegro and northern Greece and Macedonia and so on. So when you said earlier, and I didn't correct you, that the Kosovo Albanians didn't want independence but autonomy, no, they really did want independence. And in fact, independence would just be a stepping stone towards merging with Albania and onward. There's sites out there, there's maps, there's official Albanian organizations endorsing this. So it's not some sort of grand conspiracy theory, it's a fact.
No, I guess, yeah, I was more referring to just the actual circumstances, as you say, that it wasn't a possibility. Now, I talked with Eric Garris a little bit about this, and he said, you know, this is, you know, obviously way overblown by the right wing, and I'm not saying he was believing in this or something. He was just using it as an example. But, you know, all the right wing conspiracy theories about how all the Mexicans want to take back Aztlan and have some kind of autonomous thing in Southern California or some kind of thing like that, that he basically made the analogy that, you know, if that kind of right wing paranoid thing was actually happening, that basically this would be like if George Bush or, you know, Obama sent the National Guard there to, you know, kind of keep them within the country or whatever, that it wasn't even really like South Carolina declaring secession from the Union. It was more like...
That's very true, yeah. And, you know, personally, when I'm asked about these parallels, I refrain from making them because, in my view... I don't think the immigrants from Mexico would really want to annex these areas to Mexico.
Oh, clearly not. Yeah. And, Garris said, too, this is...
They wouldn't want to annex it to Mexico right away.
Yeah. No, obviously, people that come here because they want to live here, right. Not because they want to take here with them back where they came from or whatever. I don't know how that's supposed to work anyway. But,
right.
Obviously we all understand that's a WorldNet daily fantasy, but the point was to try to come up with a metaphor for, like, this was less than a civil war going on here. It was kind of a, you know, internal subversion sort of a thing, much less than, a real civil war or an outright secession. Play.
Right. Well, what Clinton said about the Albanians not being able to use their language and so forth, I mean, that was just complete BS. The Serbs, the communists, but the Republic of Serbia had built universities for Albanians, had built schools and hospitals. The Albanians in Kosovo had more rights than Albanians in Albania proper. Because Enver Hoxha, when he took power in 1945, he pretty much executed all the literate people in Albania so that he would have a clean slate and start afresh as a communist. Whereas all the literate Albanians for years, and you know the Albanian anti-communists, ironically, found refuge in communist Yugoslavia. I remember with incongruity the fact that there's this. I think he's related to the current foreign minister of the so-called Republic of Kosovo. They share the same last name, which is not uncommon. He writes from Boston. And a couple of years back, I translated a piece of his in which he's saying, you know, this is not a fight for independence, this is a fight for reunification with Albania, which is what we really want. And then in his biographical information, it stood that, you know, he worked for the Yugoslav Foreign Ministry until 1999. So this fellow who claims that Albanians have suffered 15 genocides and have been horrendously oppressed by the Serbs for 100 years actually had a job in the Serbian government.
Yeah, well, that sounds about right for
American
media. Exactly. At least they admitted it in the byline, right?
Well, it wasn't in the byline to that particular article.
Ah.
It was in the biographical information on a different site because they were introducing him a few years earlier somewhere in New England, and he was giving a speech. So the Internet is a wonderful thing. You really can't hide anything anymore.
Yeah, that is true. And also, you know, look on the bright side. At least he wasn't just straight from a public relations firm on Madison Avenue.
Very true.
He knew something about what he was spinning.
That's true. I mean,
we'll have to call that victory.
Yeah. That might have been total crap, but at least he passionately believed it. And he wasn't just paid to spout it. That's something, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, we need to do this more often. I really appreciate your time on the show today, as I'm sure many in the audience do as well.
thank you for having me. Yeah, I'd be up for this more often as your schedule allows.
Okay, great. Everybody, that's Naboi Samalek. It's Moments of Transition is the name of his column at antiwar.com/Malik. And also he keeps a blog at grayfalcon.blogspot.com. This is Antiwar Radio from L.A. in Austin, Texas. We'll be right back.